really go bad on 13 volts.
There's a couple bits.
I'm amazed. I don't think it's the right way to go, though. Some final words from you, Steve. Go right ahead. And please come back each week and let us know how this project is working. As I said, you've got an exciting project where you're working with some pretty high-energy physics. And I know voltage is your business, so I can see some of the reason why you want to build it yourself. I think I would also, if I was in your shoes. KD2HUC, KQIW, and the TechNet.
Well, common stick and two wheel.
By the way, when the cars get that big, you got fire as a problem.
Is that why that super amplifier of yours was called a fire maker or something like that? Is that true, Eric?
Yeah, the proper name is Phase, you know, as in Phase. Phase Linear is the name of the manufacturer. But it earned the nickname Flame Linear because all it took was one transistor to short out and you had the cascade effect across 48 pairs.
That's a lot of smoke and flames. KD2HUC, K2RHW. Go ahead, Steve.
Yeah, I'm not too worried about the fire and insulation portion of the project, Dick. As you know, big power is my business. But I may just build the transformer then, and just to see if I can do it. I have the core, I have the wire. I might as well just wind it. It sounds like from what I'm hearing, Eric pointed out the filtering. I think it was Eric. So I guess the full bridge would be the way to design the winding for. And then after that, we'll see where it goes. In the meantime, I'll send you a picture so you see what I'm talking about. KD2HUC, I thank everybody for their time.
Yeah, keep us up to date on this one, Steve. It's an exciting project. Rich N2EO, we spent the first 25 minutes of the TechNet on your particular subject, so please be a little bit brief. N2EO, K2RAW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick. No, I don't want you to discuss me. I wanted to get talk about power supplies about Steve. And my question about what Steve said, you know, when engineers or techs build a power supply, they invariably put the choke in the positive line just for the capacitors. And I know, and maybe you can answer this, and most people would never think of this. On a bridge rectifier, you could put the choke in the negative side to ground. Or on a full-wave center tap supply, the choke on the center tap to ground. That eliminates the problem with having the winding short to the core and create a real problem. Also, another thing as far as regulation, developed by Collins many years ago, they would use a swinging choke, and they would put a capacitor across their choke, so it would make a resonant circuit in 120 cycles when the choke was not swinging. This gave it extra regulation. You familiar with these techniques? The two of them, Dick and Tulio.
Yes, I am, Rich. That power supply for 2,000 volts, to feed those four CX250B tubes of my strip line kilowatt power amplifier. That was the April-May issue. The May issue, QST 1972, did have choke input, and the choke was on the negative lead, the center tap of the transformer lead to ground. And the reason I did it is what you indicated, so that now the 2,000 volts, so to speak, is not continuously sitting on that choke trying to arc it to ground. The choke had an average voltage of 0 volts. One of its leads was grounded. The choke is still a choke input power supply. It's still in series with the diodes, just on the other side of the transformer windings. And that saves you a lot of grief. And yes, the so-called swinging choke idea is another beautiful one. You get some regulation out of that. You can get some regulation out of the solar transformer. So there's lots and lots of ways of building power supplies. And when it comes to a really high power current, you know, thousands of amperes, they do that. We're going to go over to the other Joe now, Joe number two, V2RYY, doing all kinds of antenna research for the last few months. How's it going, Joe? The V2RYY, K2IW in the TechNet.
Oh, very good, very good. I want to discuss a method of how to test an antenna tuner, because I got one coming in the mail. I finally broke down and bought one. I want to discuss a method of testing an antenna tuner without testing it into an antenna by using test equipment. I have an idea what I could probably do to do something like this, but I just want to throw it over to you and as in discussion to see what you would do to be able to test the antenna tuner. It has a frequency range of 160 meters, 80, 40, 20, 15, and 10, I believe, are the positions of the selector switch on the for the inductor inside. Rated at about 1,000 watts, so you don't know, I'm not going to run any kind of like power like that at all into it. But what would you do to be able to test something like that to basically know its performance range? Back to you.
It almost doesn't need confirmation, Joe. If I was building a building, and I want to make sure that my bricks that are going into the building are real good, I could drop each one of the bricks and make sure that gravity pulls it down. Of course, that's a ridiculous test. If the brick has got approximately the right size and the right hardness, you're going to get a building out of it. You don't have to test the bricks per se. If you study the schematic diagram, most antenna tuners have something like a L network, pi network, pi L network. In other words, you know the value of the C2 capacitor, what is its minimum maximum. You know the value of the C1 capacitor, minimum maximum. The inductor is probably a switching inductor. There's a switch across the turn. How many of the turns you're using is a function of which band you're on. So that as long as the switch in there doesn't have a current limit and arc over, you can tell what part of the Smith chart will be covered as you go through the range of those capacitors and inductors studying the schematic diagram. I didn't say that's easy. I'll admit that that's a whole other art and science that has to be adapted. But a person with a fairly heavy RF engineering background might be able to do that. Other than that, to really test it under full power, all possible working conditions, you're not going to live long enough. You can choose all possible load resistors from 10 ohms to 2,000 ohms and all kinds of capacitive and inductive loads, all kinds of visuals. As you can see, that to test all possible working conditions is not easy. And what's your definition of it working well? Let me drop it. Your highest priority is to make sure something doesn't arc over, or under high current conditions, which might be a particular inductive load with a 10 to 1 standing wave ratio. That might be the highest internal current inside of your coil selecting switches, the band switch of your antenna tuner. And you want to make sure it doesn't arc over and the currents don't burn and the contacts don't burn up. So, not an easy one. By way of multiple dummy loads that you put in parallel or series, which is possible, by way of plugging in some inductors and or capacitors in that load, there's various ways you can create a lot of different load conditions. What you're going to find out is that there's one huge bit of missing information. If that antenna tuner manufacturer was the best guy in the world, for each one of those bands, 80, 40, 20, 15, and 10, and the walk bands, he would give you a Smith chart, and he would color in the portion of the Smith chart where the antenna tuner can handle it without running out of range. You don't have that secret piece of information. He didn't give it to you. By way of a whole bunch of lab testing and or studying the schematic diagram, you could fill in that Smith chart as to what impedances it will handle. But that's a fair amount of work. A simple no-go test of a pair of dummy loads in parallel, a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. Through various, in fact, there's a clue. You don't have to put in the inductors and capacitors for the load. Just by changing the length of the transmission line. Let me drop it. By changing the length of the transmission line between the antenna tuner and the mismatched dummy load, the two dummy loads in parallel, so to speak, that will give you all possible phase angles. You are now electronically in the transmission line creating the inductor and creating the capacitor. I can give you a formula where you tell me what the load is, 10 ohms, 15 ohms, 300 ohms. You tell me the load resistor. And with this simple formula, you can plug into your calculator. You tell me the length of your transmission line in phase degrees. Quarter wave would be 90 degrees. And I can tell you what is the input impedance to that line, how much inductance and how much resistance will be created by that length of line. So therefore, that's the easiest way to create all the possible phase angles, changing that line length by plugging in a length of line with adapters, if you know what I mean, Steve. Here we go, Joe. W2LYY, K2LAW in the Tech Net.
Isn't the antenna tuner primarily used for the purpose, the primary purpose of matching impedances from input to output? And if that is the case, you assume that's what it's primarily built to do. Can you use a variable resistive type of device, call it that for right now, on the output to be able to go up to a certain range and be able to tell, you know, it can resolve up to this type of resistance load on its output before it's beyond its capacity per frequency band? That's more or less what I was getting at. I wasn't talking about putting power into the thing and testing to see if it's going to arc over.
Okay. You're coming up with various techniques of making a variable resistor. In theory, you can buy or build or get on the surplus market a great big rheostat or whatever it's called, a huge high-power potentiometer by which you can put in various resistors. A smarter amateur who wants to save some money builds up a great big board with a whole bunch of incandescent light bulbs, and he puts some number of light bulbs in series and parallel and screws them in and unscrews them to make various resistive loads. The problem is the real world is almost never a pure resistor. Almost every antenna you and I have ever built that's got any amount of standing wave ratio is quite often a significant amount of inductance or capacitance in series with that antenna as far as the equivalent circuit is concerned. What I was saying is that use whatever method you like, light bulbs, rheostat, or whatever, to make, or putting dummy loads in parallel to make whatever resistor you want, but to now simulate the next step. The real world always has a reactor. By varying the length of transmission line between your antenna tuner and that resistive mismatched load, by varying the transmission line, you can create any amount of series inductance or capacitance you want just by choosing the right length of line. I know that's not obvious at first. It's kind of crafty, but it can save you a lot of grief of testing the real world. Over to you, Steve. Joe. W2LYY, K2LAW.
AC2QAQ with a comment?
Joe first, and then we'll go over to Glenn. Go ahead, Joe.
If you want me to change my name to Steve, I'll change my name to Steve just to be used, Dick. You seem to have Steve in your life tonight for some reason. So you don't think using something is simple? I'm trying to make this simple, and I'm not talking about running high power now. I'm not going to run any power into it to test it. I said that in the beginning. I want to use test equipment, something like a tracking generator with a return loss bridge on the input where I can look at the return loss at a frequency and find out how much I can vary the output resistance or effective impedance across the output to know what up to what range I can go to before it won't be solved anymore. That's primarily what I was sort of, you know, kind of getting at. Wasn't talking about putting power into the thing at all. I will eventually when I get the thing and hook it up. But it's just sort of a curiosity question to find out what can I resolve an approximate impedance at the output of the tuner. I understand if you have inductances and capacity and resistive loads on an antenna circuit, complete circuit or transmission line. I do understand that. But to be able to cut up a bunch of line and try this lane, try that length line, that's a lot of work, don't you think?
No, I don't. And you don't have to cut the line. Just by choosing various lengths of line you got laying around your laboratory, you'll be doing that. And you don't have to put power. By way of whatever method you may use for measuring standing wave ratio or reflected power at the input level, at the input connector of your antenna tuner, you'll find out, does the antenna tuner achieve, let me call it resonance, achieve impedance match for your particular dummy load. Your dummy load is going to have some amount of mismatched resistor, too high or too low. But now by various lengths of line in each of those bands, or the same length of line in various bands, you'll also be creating a predictable amount of reactance to find out, will it resonate, even at low power, and give you no standing wave ratio at the input. Glenn and Eric in that order. KC2QIQ, K2IW, go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, very good, Dick. Actually, from 1 gigahertz up, that's exactly the method that I use. I usually have a set of bird loads here, you know, the 100, 500 watt class, and a bunch of T connectors, you know, type N T connectors, and I can put them together and basically do 50 ohms, 2 to 1, you know, which is like 25, 3 all the way up to, I usually will check up to 4 to 1, and I'll put something like a trombone in between, or a phase shifter, that it basically I can just lengthen and shorten the feed line, and that gives me very good results. In HF, I do take another approach. Let me let it drop. The other approach I do with HF is because of the problem that Joe just mentioned, that with the coaxes, I've tried that in the past, and it's like too many gaps that are missing, and to try to get the lengths long enough and things, it's not too practical. But what I have done is I take another similar antenna tuner and terminate it with loads and then basically mismatch the other antenna tuner. So I'm feeding an antenna tuner into an antenna tuner. Then when I can't straighten out the VSWR anymore, I can go back to the other antenna tuner and look at the settings on it, and I can figure out what that impedance is of the other antenna tuner. K2IW, K2QIQ.
Yeah, that's very crafty, Glenn. To use an antenna tuner tied together to a dummy load, and by that becomes a complex load. And by changing the dials on that second antenna tuner, you're now creating any impedance you want, per se, for the load of the first antenna tuner. Very crafty. One other thing I want to mention to you, Joe, and, okay, here we go. Sorry about that. Yeah, this is Joe. Joe and Glenn, and that is to put dummy loads, high-power dummy loads, because that's the best thing you got that's got quality, or if you want to do it at the milliwatt level, go ahead and use low-power dummy loads. But to put dummy loads in parallel by way of a T-connector is easy. Do it with a predictable impedance. To put them in series is difficult. So to make a 25-ohm load is easy. To make a 100-ohm load is hard. Not really. If the length of transmission line between the antenna tuner on the test and that dummy load of 25 ohms, 250s in parallel, if that is a quarter wavelength of line, it does impedance inverting. The 25-ohm load becomes a 100-ohm load through a quarter wavelength of line. So you can now create higher resistance loads as well as reactive loads by going longer and shorter than the quarter wave length of line. Let's see what Eric's got to say on all this. KE2EJ, K2RIW, the second half.
K2RIW, K2EJ. Oh, look, Glenn's idea. I was doing something similar to that. I built a tank circuit, basically. Two capacitors, tuned a rolling inductor coil. That's what I did many years ago. But the one thing that I wanted to point out for Joe was that from last week's discussion, he really doesn't have any way to measure reactions with his setup. What he really, you know, that little bit of information is going to leave a gap. I mean, either you calculate what the actual reaction component is for each particular setup and then mark that off on the Smith chart as to where it is as he's going through the various different frequencies and ranges with the tuner. One thing I will say, most of the antenna tuners that are made by MFJ, they've got good range. Some of them are like 20 to 1. But the problem is the waiver switches. And the way people tune, they don't realize that they wind up parking the damn things over and turning it into mincemeat. So, K2RIW, K3J.
That's another important structure statement that Eric just made. There's lots of ways of mistuning an antenna tuner when you're creating a lot of steam at the transmitter. There's ways you can force the antenna tuner into resonance with a mismatched load, mismatched tuning, such that the internal currents in the antenna tuner can go sky high. That's not a desirable way to use it. So you can aggravate it, if you know what I mean. And now, to write an instruction manual so that you can avoid that condition, the words that go into that to be installed, to be understood by the average amateur, that's a tough one. You I've got one other advantage in your favor here, Steve. You have the ability to get your hands on some very low insertion loss coax. If you use multiple wavelengths of coax, a great big roll of it, like you had in your basement at one time, and under certain conditions you can get it back into your basement for a test, so to speak, you've now got a low loss length of line of multiple wavelengths. As you swish the frequency on, say, for instance, 80 meters, and you go from 3.5 to 3.7 to 3.9 to 4.0, that same length of line, which is multiple wavelengths long, by you selecting the frequency, you'll get all the phase angles you want. The multiple length of line, see the way the impedance inverting and the changing an inductor is created by the number of phase degrees of the line. It's not its feet of length, it's its phase length. And so you can change the phase length by changing the frequency. That's the equivalent of sliding the length of the line. So if you start off with a long enough length of line, of low enough force, you have the equivalent of a trombone by using the main frequency dial on your transmitter. W2RYY, K2RIW in the TechNet. Interesting problem.
I guess I have to ask you the direct question because, you know, beating around the bush doesn't really work. It seems to be here. All right, here's a direct question, which I guess will require a direct answer. Can I use a non-inductive resistance, variable resistance, like a carbon pot of some sort of watt, 5 watt, 10 watt, something like that, that has a range going up to 1,000 ohms? Because I want to be able to test the effective impedance below 50 ohms and a well above 50 ohms to be able to determine the total antenna tuning range for frequency. That's what I was basically trying to get at. I understand, you know, you can make a problem very complex or very simple.
Make it under 100 milliwatts.
You want a simple answer? Yes. Back to you, Joe.
Okay, well, that's what I'll do then. Thank you.
Okay, we're going to go over to John. KC2SHO, K2RIW. Go ahead, John. Hoping to put you to sleep with all this jazz.
K2RIW, KC2SHO. No, not falling asleep at all. Working around the shop here, listening to you guys, always enjoy it. But real quick, last week it came up, discussion of balance. I'm sorry, this radio must have a shorter timeout than I'm used to. I'll have to correct that. But anyway, real quick, what happens when you put a 1-to-1 balun where a T used to be? What happens when you put a 4-to-1 balun where a T? Turning on a different radio here, then. Going to have to correct that. Anyway, the question was, what happens when you put the different balun where a T used to be? What is the actual effect? What will the experience be by the operator? If you have a T, you replace it with a 1-to-1 balance. What happens if you take that and now change it to a 4-to-1 balance? How about some of the other ratios as well? K2RIW, KC2SHO.
Yeah, you've mentioned the word T a couple of times, and there's a huge ambiguity there, John. Are you telling me that you... where your coax cable normally goes to the antenna, you put a T connector there and nothing on the third line, or there is something on the third line? You keep telling us you're using a T. There's only an infinite number of ways of using the T. There's a lot of hidden information. You got to reveal some of these secrets, John. KC2SHO, K2RIW.
Yeah, good point, and T might not even be the right way to say that. So, some dipoles are just said, you know, the shield goes to one side and the center conductor goes to the other. So my using T probably is not correct. So if I have an antenna, a dipole, where the shield feeds one end and the center conductor feeds the other, what happens when I replace it with the different ratios of balance? What will my experience be?
Okay. The fact that you had the shield of the coax going directly to one side of the dipole means that the outer conductor of your coaxial cable was part of the antenna, and it was hot with RF, and therefore lengthening and shortening the transmission line will change the tuning of the antenna, and it'll drive you up a wall, and it causes all kinds of people to say, take a look at my standing wave ratio measured with my well-calibrated bird wattmeter. For instance, look at that VizRock going up and down as I change the length of the line. Therefore, there must be a magic length of line where the VizRock disappears. Well, because you're changing the length of a hot line, which is another resonator in the system, it can give you all kinds of answers. The fact that you now go over to a balun. The balun is like a one-to-one transformer. It thoroughly isolates the shield of the transmission line. If the balun is doing its job, the shield of the transmission line will no longer get hot. You're not putting any RF on it. It's not part of the tuned circuit. Now, you've got a pure feeding of a dipole. If the dipole happened to be exactly the right resonant length, let me drop it. And it's some reasonable length above ground, an altitude above ground, it's approximately a 73-ohm resistor, and 73 ohms on a 50-ohm line fed with a 1-to-1 balun is something like a 1.3 or whatever it is standing wave ratio. 73 ohms divided by 50 ohms is the exact number, so to speak. You get a little bit of VizRock there. If you use a 4-to-1 balun, where the 4-to-1 balun in my example is now taking a 50-ohm line, and if you're using it in one direction, you're stepping up the 50-ohm line to 200 ohms. Now you're putting 200 ohm source with balun into a 73-ohm resistor. What is the new VizRock? It's 200 divided by 73. And that's what? Something like a 3-to-1. Yeah, something like 3-to-1 standing wave ratio. And so you're going to get various resistive standing wave ratios by way of taking various ratios of balun and connecting them to your dipole. And it's quite predictable, in my opinion. And so in that particular example, a well-balanced antenna giving you a 3-to-1 or 2.5-to-1 standing wave ratio with a non-hot piece of coax, a short length of it, and an antenna tuner that can easily carry, you handle that amount of VizRock, that could be a very highly effective system. As bad as it sounds, it might have 97% efficiency if you've got a low enough lost piece of coax cable and not too much of it. So what you're going to get from those crazy numbers of balun now becomes very predictable. Whereas, when you connect the shield of the cable directly to the dipole, it's nowhere near as predictable. The length of the transmission line, which is now hot with RF, is a big variable, and how the transmission line is dressed is part of it laying up against a sheet metal ductwork, and part of it laying against the ground. I mean, under normal circumstances, let me drop it. You're using coax cable correctly. All of the signal is on the inside of the coax cable. And whether you wind it in coils and lay it up against sheet metal and make fairly sharp bends and lay it against the ground, all of that doesn't matter. But when you don't have a balun and the shield goes directly to the antenna and now the coax cable is hot, the way you dress that cable makes all kinds of changes. You can run your hand up and down the transmission line out of shield and watch the VizRock going up and down. And some guys have done that. So use of a balun is a very desirable thing to do, even if it's the wrong balun, if you know what I mean. Over to you, John. KC2SHO, K2RIW in the TechNet. Good question.
Well, I don't know if I have much more. That's a wonderful answer, and gives me a lot to think about. I was just thinking about, last week we were talking about the ladder line, ladder dipole alpha delta, and the way I'm feeding it, and I have some balance here, and I was wondering if I would get better results by changing out that thing I'm calling the T connector and going to the 1-to-1 balun, or playing with some other values, if I would get better results, need less of a tuner. But it sounds like it may not really matter, although I may find some value there.
Yeah, you being a good scientist as a ham radio operator, John, you're going to run these experiments with all the balun you own, various ways of connecting it. And if I know you, you're going to fill some of this up into a notebook, and you're going to come back and report to us periodically as to what you saw, what does it mean, how well did it work, did something not work. We like hearing all of that. As somebody told us in the past, a guy who studies a schematic diagram and predicts what's going to happen, that's an engineer. The guy who's out and tested, if you're using a derogatory professor, he'll say, oh, that's just a technician. A real scientist. is more than an engineer, so to speak. He wants experimental confirmation. One good experiment is a hell of a lot better than a thousand theories sometimes. So, experimental real evidence. I mean, that's how I made what I think is a minor breakthrough in antenna design, by doing real experimental testing with a simple piece of copper tape on the end of a stick as a tuning tool when using an experimental measurement on a vector network analyzer of a 915 megacycle antenna. That experiment, that so-called technician work, which in my opinion was really science work, allowed me to discover what I think is a whole new class of extremely broadband, extremely high performance, three-element Yagi antennas for 915 megs. I could give you the serial number of that particular patent. And you look at the schematic diagram of that three-element Yagi antenna in that patent, and you'll say, where the hell did that crazy shape come from? It's an extremely high-performance, very exotic-looking shape. It is a three-element Yagi, made out of a simple piece of sheet metal, so to speak, or a piece of copper tape cut in just the right shape, and pasted up against a
repeater. Time out.
Copper tape of the right shape pasted up against a piece of plastic. How in the world can that crazy shape give you all of that huge bandwidth and huge low standing wave ratio across all of that 902 to 928 megs? You can't buy that antenna, but you can cut it up in 10 minutes with a pair of scissors, and all that high performance will come to you. That was discovered as a purely empirical experiment. Maybe I was being a technician. I think I was being a scientist. You be the judge. So we like experiments. That's what the real ham radio is. That's where it comes from. That's where we make the breakthroughs. A real smart ham radio operator, acting as a scientist, he does an experiment, he expects X, and all of a sudden he gets Y as a result. And if he's got any real curiosity, he'll say, why the hell did it do that? He starts running a couple of tests, and he says, oh, that's why it's happening. Hey, that's a brand new component. I'm going to patent it. Keep it up, you guys. Make sure you don't lose your curiosity. Here's the most curious guy we know on Long Island. KE2EJ, K2RAW. Go ahead, curious guy. Go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, this little discussion reminded me of a question I've been meaning to ask you. In your description of this antenna that you developed, you always talk about the vector network analyzer had a display of the gain. So that got me to wondering, what did you use as a reference to making all these measurements that you actually were able to obtain the gain?
Oh boy, I'm going to give you a big pile of money. Am I glad you asked that question? Unfortunately, I've got to be a little bit brief in the answer because you now got me on my favorite dump-out subject. The nice thing about making a three-element Yagi with 6.0 dB over isotropic gain, the maximum the FCC will allow you to use on the license-free 915 megacycle band, is that you calculate what is the effective capture area of that antenna. It is an 8-inch diameter circle. What is the near-field range? 2 feet. My antenna range consisted of my desk and my conference table, 3 feet apart. On the conference table, sitting on a piece of foam, was another three-element Yagi, almost identical in design. The pair of three-element Yagis, the one that was under test, that was on my desk, and the one that was the receiving device on my conference table, they went into two separate cables, J1 and J2 of the antenna, of the vector network analyzer. The S21, the throughput gain, the throughput signal level of that system, once you calibrate it, that is the gain. So the gain was how much signal flowed out of the second antenna when I transmitted it to the first antenna. And the standing wave ratio was how much signal got reflected from the antenna on the test. So the J1 cable made the two measurements. It injected the signal for the gain measurement, and it looked at the reflected signal for the VISWR. The second cable picked up the signal from the receiving antenna on the conference table. Now, with using two... Let me drop.
Calibrated to the closed loop.
By using the two colors on the XY plot, horizontal was frequency, vertical was decibels, 5 or 10 dB per box, depending on whether I wanted high resolution or not. The blue curve was gain. I did whatever tuning required to make that go up. The yellow curve was reflected signal. I did whatever required to make that go down. Calibrating it was the Friis method. The Friis method, F-R-I-I-S, means you take a pair of identical antennas. You don't even have to know the gain of the antennas. You simply know that they're identical. And if you have any doubt whether or not they're identical, you periodically plug in a third antenna and test number one against number three and number two against number three. So you got two identical antennas. You don't know what the hell the gain is, but by way of the Friis method, you know the number of feet of separation between the two. You know the frequency you're using. A simple calculation tells you what is the Friis space loss. The Friis space loss over 3 feet at 915 megacycles is 30.2 decibels. Let me drop. So the Friis space loss is 30.2. If each antenna had 0 dB of gain, isotropic, I would measure an insertion loss of 30.2 dB because it's 3 foot of range and 915 megacycles. If I measure 12 dB less than that, and the two antennas are identical, then I know that each antenna is exactly 6 dB of gain. Very simple calculation. Should I run that by again, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW, the TechNet.
No, that's kind of what I was thinking, that you had to do something that was at least identical to what we were working with. Come on, because you never talk about the source of the signal. You only talk about what happens to it. So, you know, it was just that missing bit of information, but very cool. And I like the fact that I didn't think about, you have the three space loss, so there's 3 feet between them. And from that, you can tell several things. You can tell the antennas are identical and calculate what the actual gain is. Very cool. K2IW, K2EJ.
There's a man with good taste. Now, you take a bunch of, 4-inch thick AN75 Emerson Cumming absorbing foam made for anechoic chambers. You lay some of that on the floor. You lay some of it against the back wall. You lay some of it against the forward wall, far away from this antenna range. You hang some of it with tape from the ceiling. Now all the reflection, the undesired reflections from the room, except for the reflection from the human being, are controlled. And while I'm watching that screen, I move my body around, and if I put my body in a spot where if I move it around, the curves on the screen don't change. I know that I'm in a so-called dead spot, and I got a long enough stick with a piece of tape on the end, and I'm now doing the testing. That is an extremely high performance antenna range for this very narrow band kind of testing. Only good for a 902 to 928 megacycle, 3-element, 6 dB gain, Yagi antenna, where you only care about forward gain of the main lobe. Let me drop. I have a high amount of desire to know with high accuracy the forward gain of the main lobe. You have a high accuracy requirement for knowing the exact amount of reflected power or standing wave ratio. And that's all I cared about. Didn't give a damn about the pattern, side lobe levels, front to back ratio, all of that jazz. Because I didn't need to measure all of those things, I didn't need a anechoic chamber for that very narrow band kind of testing. That simple looking antenna range, which was set up there for 5 years, 8 years in a row. Lots of people came into that office measuring 900 megacycle antennas and they walked away happy, knowing that what they were doing was traceable to the Bureau within a couple of tenths of a dB. When the main antenna maven from the main headquarters of the guy in Illinois came to visit this facility way out here in Podunk, Long Island, so to speak, from his point of view, let me drop. And he knew that a whole slew of patents were coming out of this building. And he takes a couple of his young pump engineers and says, we're going to go see what the hell's going on out there. And he goes out there to see where all these patents are coming from. And he asked to see the antenna range. And he saw that particular setup by comparison to the 50 and 100 foot long great big anechoic chambers he is using for the testing he was doing. He looked at that range. He turned his nose up in the air. He turned around and said, you guys are crazy. He didn't say that in words. He said it with his eye expression, if you know what I mean. And he started walking out of the room. I think you heard the story already. I caught him saying, hey, whenever I interview a new antenna engineer, I give him a particular electrical engineering antenna puzzle. Would you like to see what that puzzle is? That stopped him in his tracks. And I started showing him the puzzle. And you've heard the results of that story. All of a sudden, he had a brand new respect for us. But when he looked at our so-called antenna range compared compared to what he had been using for the last 25 years. At first, he thought we were crazy. He didn't realize that in the... Let me drop it. In the world of RFID, radio frequency identification tag testing, and antennas for making that measurement, for using the interrogator, the RFID measuring device, that you've got a very narrow band set of requirements. Forward gain and reflected signal, that's all you care about. All the 40,000 other measurements you do in an antenna range don't matter in that environment. So therefore, at first, what he thought was a crazy antenna range, he suddenly realized what for that environment was very high performance. It was extremely different from what he expected, and at first he was rejecting the living daylights out of it. Any further comments on this one, Eric? K3EJ, K2IW, awful great you asked that question.
Oh, that's a good story, Dick. But it shows a lot about sociology and engineers and how they live in society, so to speak. Good story. All right. It was just something that was nagging at me. I just wanted to get the picture of what was the story of K2EJ.
You're absolutely right for that to nag you, Eric. When you talk to real experienced antenna chamber antenna engineers, they'll tell you it's the highest thing in the world, difficult to measure. Precise amount of forward gain. And if you can measure it to the nearest plus or minus half or three quarters of a dB with a whole lot of work, they think they've hit pay dirt. In my particular case, because the distance between the transmitting Yagi and the receiving Yagi was 3 feet, and the near-field range is only 2 feet, and so way outside the near-field range. When you've got a range that's only 3 feet long, and the floor and the ceiling and the walls are all a zillion feet away by comparison, and they're covered with absorbing material, that very yucky-looking antenna range is extremely high in performance, because all the echoes in the room that count for that forward lobe measurement are all 40 dB down, so to speak. A well-calibrated vector network analyzer has measurements of decibels to the nearest tenth or 0.05 dB, probably a 20th of a dB. Therefore, that simple-looking test equipment can make exact gain measurements by that freeze technique accurate to probably better than a tenth of a dB. You talk to any antenna engineer working in a real anechoic chamber, and you tell him that in my environment, I can measure absolute gain of an antenna to the nearest tenth of dB, every one of them will tell you, what the hell are you smoking? If we can barely get within half a dB with a couple of days worth of work, we think we've hit pay dirt. Well, in their particular environment, where they're testing a very different kind of antenna, and they're testing it over a 50-foot range, and all the walls and ceiling of that chamber, even though they're covered with anechoic material, in that environment, the main lobe of each of those antennas is hitting the walls and giving them beautiful reflections off the tips of those foam. So,
repeater, time out.
So even though they've spent a zillion dollars on their great big anechoic chamber, their measurements are a hell of a lot lower in accuracy because they're trying to really measure pattern. They're measuring great big antennas, great big long ranges, but they're getting echoes off of those walls. Because my range was so damn short, by the inverse square law, all the undesired echoes in that room were so many wavelengths away by comparison, they got suppressed by so many dB that very simple-looking range became very high in accuracy. Ain't that crazy, Eric? KE2EJ, K2LAW, it really fools you when you first see it.
That's a very cool picture, Dick. K2IW, K2EJ. It reminds me of some of the broadcast antenna companies and their ranges. They're all outdoors. But they have spaces that are bigger than like 3 and 4 football fields where they test that kind of stuff. But that's a whole different animal with a whole different concept of what it needs to do. K2IW, K2EJ.
Yeah, in my opinion, a smart engineer tailors the test for his particular requirement. Don't have to follow the tradition. The tradition for antenna testing is a great big anechoic chamber. That is the set in stone method of measuring antennas that's got 40 or 60 years of history, and everybody thinks it's got to be done that way. I met one other guy once who thinks the way I do. The guy in Boston, Massachusetts, can't think of his name right now. He happens to be a ham radio operator, and he is considered the guru of fractal antennas. I think the name of his company is Fractal, the Fractal Antenna Company, or something very close to that. Had a nice conversation with him, and for his simple fractal antennas on VHF, UHF frequencies, he had a very similar antenna range in his laboratory that looked very non-conventional. But for the testing he needed, it gave him the answers. So you don't have to follow the tradition. You don't have to do it the same way everybody else does it. It was a huge advantage at times by going off the beaten track. I think we've answered all the questions of the people who signed in. Yes, I think we have. And so we're only 50 minutes later than we should be. But that schedule, we told everybody it was going to be a loose schedule, John. KC2WGB. Are those guys going to stump us again, the people who write to you? Over to you, John, K2RIW, the Tech Man. Let's hear some mailbag stuff.
W2RY?
Stand by a minute, John. You got a quickie question, Joe?
Yeah, reference to what you were just talking about for the past 5 minutes. Did you ever try another antenna in place of your production design antenna to see how much the gain would fall, like, say, using a standard EMI antenna in that frequency range? Did you ever try that as a substitute?
The standard EMI antenna did not do that. And it's not required. Yes, that is the standard, the EMI antenna, when you've only got one. The Priest technique tells you get a huge advantage as long as whatever antennas you're testing, you've got an identical pair of them. And if there's any doubt as to whether or not they're identical, you pick up a third antenna and compare each one of them to the third. So once you've got a pair of identical antennas, you haven't the vaguest idea what the absolute gain of it is, but you know they're identical. And by way of your extreme faith in the ability to calculate pre-space loss for a given number of feet at a given number of megacycles, and as you put these two antennas looking directly at each other, boresight to boresight, directly aimed at each other, whatever number of decibels you see lower than the free space loss, that is the gain of your pair of antennas. That technique is considered the bedrock of the antenna measuring technique when it comes to measuring absolute gains. Let me drop quick. So once in a blue moon, a guy running an anechoic chamber will set up a Priest test with an identical pair of tests, identical pair of antennas, in order to calibrate the insertion loss of his chamber, in order to be able to calibrate the absolute gain of some other unknown antenna. My crazy antenna range was using this bedrock testing technique called the Priest technique. I used it every single day as the measurement procedure. You can't get any closer to the Bureau than that, if you know what I mean, Joe. The B2RYY, K2RIW.
Okay, great. Now, I was just curious if you tried another substitute antenna in there, but apparently you did it, by a different method. Okay, very good.
Well, a slightly different question you didn't ask is, did I pick up other brands of RFID antennas and plug them into the antenna range? Absolutely. And there were times we found some crazy numbers. There were certain almost respectable antenna manufacturing companies. You pick up their antenna and put it on our antenna range, and they're supposed to have exactly 60 dB of gain with or without circular polarization. There were times we saw some huge differences on either direction. In theory, if you built an RFID measuring antenna, and if by FCC standards it has more than 6.0 dB of isotropic gain, in theory you're violating their laws. In theory you're subject to a fine. In theory. Let's face it, in the real world it's a somewhat victimless crime 99% of the time. But if you're in the manufacturing business of an RFID measuring setup, you're not allowed to exceed 6.0 dB of gain for license-free operation. You're not allowed to put more than 1 watt of power into it. Them's the rules. That's what the friendly gambling company says. Hey, John, KC2WGB, K2IW. You got it, John.
KC2WGB. Good evening, Dick, Paul, everyone on the net. Yeah, we have a tight schedule, about as tight as water. But it's all fun. I'm living in a drop. I'll go on to my first question. Yep, I collected all my stuff. I just don't know where I put it. All right. All right. This young ham has been listening to some circuit descriptions, and he needs you to help him out. We're using a term he's not familiar with, two terms, called source and sinking, or sink. He'd like you to some simple circuits and try to describe what's going on with that so he could better understand it. Dick, back to you, sir. KC2WGB.
Yeah, there are an awful lot of ways that those two words can be used. I hope I hit the way that he's got in mind. If I'm building a relatively simple RLC circuit, maybe it's got some transistors in it and whatever, and if it's a and if at first the circuit is running from a battery goes to a switch, the switch goes into a network of resistors and capacitors and inductors. I can now draw a schematic diagram of that, draw a pure vertical line through that, everything left of that, a vertical dotted line. On the left side of that dotted line is the battery. On the right side of the dotted line is the RLC circuit. In that situation, the battery is the source. It happens to be the source of power, the source of voltage, the source of current, the source of energy, any way you want to look at it. It is the source. And that complex network, simple or complex network, to the right of the dotted line, your RLC network, which could be just a simple series resistor and capacitor, or it might be 40 components, that is the sink. You're putting energy from that battery into all of that stuff. And so where is it coming from? The source. Where is it going to? The sink. That's one way of looking at it. If I'm running a source of heat, I've got current flowing through a heating device. It's a series resistor, and I'm pouring current into it. And now my source is now a source of heat on the left-hand side of the dotted line. And maybe there's a heat sink in between, and now there's transistors and other things on the right-hand side, so I could have a thermal diagram of source and sink. And in some cases, the source is a transistor that's generating...
Repeater, timeout.
In some cases, the source of heat is the transistor that's running real hard. It's screwed down to a heat sink, and the sink is... the chunk of aluminum with the fins that's dissipating the heat. So thermally speaking, the source is the transistor, and it's a thermal grease and maybe a mica washer that's under it, but the transistor is the source of the heat. The heat sink, the chunk of aluminum with the fins, is a sink. So in the world of energy flow, something is creating the energy, something is using and dissipating the energy. Using and dissipating is usually the sink, and where it comes from is usually the source. In this solar system, the major source is the sun, putting out all kinds of wavelengths of energy and particles at high velocity and high power. 10 to the 26 watts, 10 to the 27 watts is the approximate number coming out of that sun day in and day out for the last 5 billion years. Let me drop. And I put up my solar panel, or I put up my solar panel, I put up my black body panel with the sunshine on it, and I make some careful measurements, and I find out that 1,300 watts of solar energy at high noon is hitting my panel, or hitting my solar cells. So energy-wise, in that particular environment, the sun is the source, and my hot panel or my solar cells are the sink, as far as the beginning of that energy flow. Well, now, in the case of the solar cells, they are the sink as far as the sunlight shining on is concerned, but they are solar voltaics. They are generating voltage. So for the circuit that's now connected to my solar cells, things reverse. The solar cells are the source, and my circuit is the sink. It might be the lights in my house, if you know what I mean. So in that particular case, the solar cells, are they the source or the sink? The answer is yes and yes. When it comes to the sunlight, they're the sink. When it comes to the energy flowing out of them, electronically speaking, it's the source. So probably has some other examples in mind, and why don't you give them to us if you do, John? KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Well, I can assume that he can consider the source transmission and the sync the receiver. And that's interesting about the solar cells, and you're absolutely right. They're the sync, and on the other side, they become a source. Good stuff. And I hope he has fun continuing his studies in these circuits, and that can be a little confusing, because usually we're used to loads, something called a load instead of sync, so I'm sure he'll get used to it. Let me let it drop, and I'll go on for the second.
There's another thing I should add here. Source and sync is almost always considering voltage, current, power, let's call it energy. Energy is flowing from point A to point B in almost anything that we consider. Where the energy comes from, we usually call it the source. Where the energy goes to, we usually call it the sink. The second law of thermodynamics, I think it is, dictates that energy will always flow downhill. If something is hot and something else is cooler, the heat energy will flow from the hot object to the cold object. Never the other way around. Heat never flows uphill. Always flows downhill. Voltage rarely goes uphill. Voltage always goes downhill, if you know what I mean. Well, in the case of solar voltaics, there's a little bit of a difference on that one. The sun is shining its energy onto your solar cells. That's going downhill. But the energy, so to speak, could go back uphill. In theory, I could take the voltage coming out of my solar cells, putting them into some kind of a heating device, some kind of a, let's call it a light-emitting diode. I put the light-emitting diode at the focal point of my parabolic shiny reflector, and I aim the energy back at the sun. I can now make it flow what looks like uphill. However, be careful. Let me drop. One of the interesting questions is that if I take a magnifying glass that's big enough, and I focus the sun onto, say, a piece of newspaper, as I make the magnifying glass bigger and bigger and bigger, and I focus it properly, more and more energy is going into that focal point, more and more energy, but be careful. You'd like to think that I could now create enough energy so the focal point will go to 50,000 degrees Fahrenheit. No way in hell. Because if you could do that, that hot spot, everything that's hot is emitting energy. You can't stop it from doing that. I forget whose law that is. And therefore, if you think you're going to get it to 50,000 degrees, when the surface of the sun is only at 5,000 degrees, the energy coming back out of your hot spot, in theory, would flow back through your magnifying glass and go back to the sun. Because it doesn't do that, you know damn well that that hot spot, no matter how much energy you put there, can never exceed the temperature of the sun. If that hot spot, let me drop it. If it exceeded the temperature of the sun, then the energy flowing out of it would be flowing back uphill, so to speak, to the solar surface. So, whatever the temperature of the sun surface is, for the wavelength that you're using with your magnifying glass, that focused dot can get close to that temperature, can never exceed it. You'd be amazed how many puzzles go along that line, where people think they can exceed. They don't realize when they're exceeding that temperature, they're breaking the laws as far as the second law of thermodynamics. Energy always flows downhill. And you could say, from source to sink, it's always downhill. Over to you, John, K2RIW.
Well, don't forget, in looking at source to sink, the source has to be considered as a static. It's dissipating, so that it's not something that's being renewed to keep it going. So that's another way of looking at source and sink also, to keep it in proper perspective. Very good. I'm sure he's going to have a lot of fun with that. All right, I'm going to drop and we'll go on to the second.
I'm going to give you a slight exception to that one. That battery is your source. Could be a rechargeable battery, a NiCad, a lithium hydride, or whatever. In theory, when you're discharging your battery, it is the source. When you're charging it from your charging circuit, it becomes the sink. So in the case of a rechargeable battery, you can put energy back into it, John. Over to you, K2RIW.
Go ahead, query.
Want to pick that up, Dick?
Sure do. You got it, Bill.
if this 5,000 degrees is a real limit, does that mean that nuclear weapons